all.
Please be seated. Hey, good morning, Ms. Clayton.
Sorry.
For the record, ladies and gentlemen, let the record reflect that prior to these proceedings being placed on the record, that the Honorable Martin Palmer, a member of the Maryland Bar, had been introduced to the court to welcome, and that Dr. Levine, a witness in this case, had been given the oath to testify. Is there any need, gentlemen, to re-administer the oath for record purposes? Would you write that?
Dr. Levine, would you retake the witness chair, please, sir? Your name for the record, please, sir.
My name is Jérôme Lejeune.
And to help the court reporter, if she doesn't understand the French pronunciation, you spell your name J-E-R-O-M-E, capital L, little E, little J, E-U-N-E.
Perfect.
Thank you. Dr. Lejeune, from your accent, I take it that you live elsewhere than East Tennessee.
Well, I'm born on the river of the Seine, you know.
And that's probably situated in another country, I hope?
Well, it's situated in a country called France, and the little town is Paris.
Thank you, Doctor. And I guess you're a French citizen?
I'm French citizen, yes.
Born in
Parisian born.
I see. And you've traveled to this country, to Maryland, Tennessee, to offer what you have as a witness in this trial.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us, Doctor, what you do, what your profession is.
I am MD, that is, doctor in medicine. I'm also PhD, doctor in science. And after getting my degree in the University of Paris in medicine and also in genetics in the Sorbonne Faculty of Science, I was research worker for 10 years, and then I was appointed professor of fundamental genetics in the Faculty of Medicine of Paris. My special field is children, all the constitutional diseases of children, and more especially mental retardation.
Okay. Doctor, you practiced medicine, I take it, as maybe a pediatrician?
Well, I started as a pediatrician, but I specialized in genetics, and we have the biggest consultation of the world in l'Hôpital des Enfants Malades, sick children hospital in Paris, but the biggest consultation of the world for children with mental retardation due to congenital disease or due to chromosomal mistakes.
Okay. Have you been an educator as a result of your background? Have you been a teacher?
Well, I've been professor of fundamental genetics now for 20 years. But I began, my first teaching was not in France, it was in America. I was invited by Professor Beadle in Caltech, California Institute of Technology. It was just before I discovered the first disease in man, first chromosomal disease in man, but I was already involved in medical genetics. And people invited me to give the first course of human genetics in Caltech. That was long ago. At that time, my English was even rougher than it is today. And I came with all my courses in French. In the evening, I was translating them for the dictionary. And in the morning, I was delivering the course to the students. They were very kind. They helped me very greatly. That's the way I have learned to speak English. And I hope the way they have learned a little about human genetics.
Okay. You remember the year that you went to Caltech?
Well, it was in 58.
Okay. Did you remain there for some time as a professor?
I was a visiting professor from the OTAN, the professorship from the OTAN.
Okay.
NATO, you say NATO.
All right. Now, if you've been accredited with helping in human genetics with a identification of some chromosome, would you tell us about what that's about?
It happens that I discovered the first disease due to a chromosomal mistake in men, which is Down syndrome, which was called previously Mongolism, because those children have a special outlook, which is a little remembering for European some type of the Mongol features. But in Mongolia, they don't like to call the disease Mongolism. They call it European imbecility. I discovered that they had one chromosome too much, and that was long ago, 32 years, I calculate well. And for that discovery, I received the Kennedy Prize from the late president here in the United States. And also for that discovery, I got the Memorial Allen Award Medal, which is the highest award that you can get in genetics in the world is given also in the United States.
I see. Have you followed with your genetic discovery even as you sit here today? Have you continued to study?
Oh, yes.
Could you probably give us an enlightenment on what's happened over 32 years?
Well, it's... I want not to speak too much about myself, it's not the subject, but we have discovered 10 different diseases due to chromosomal errors, and I would say the first chapters of this enormous pathology was written in French by us. Now we are dealing with the mechanism of mental retardation due to chromosomal diseases, and we are beginning to understand why having one chromosome too much, that is normal information but repeated, makes a nuisance for the development of the intellect. And for example, very recently we demonstrated that in trisomy 21, Down syndrome, previously called Mongolism, the cells of the children are more sensitive to some drugs which are used against cancer. It seems totally unrelated, and in fact it's defining a new field of research, because very likely this peculiarity is related to a deficiency in a chemical system which is used especially in our neuron, and it's probably one of the main reason why they do not develop a normal intelligence. So for the moment, you ask me what we are doing now, we are working on this particular hypothesis because it allows us to make experiments on cells taken from the children. We cultivate and we can manipulate, we deep freeze them, we fold them, we play with them, and we use a lot of drugs to see how they do react, and that is the first time that we cannot experiment in human cells so that to try to cure a neuronal disease, a nervous disease. So it's a very exciting field, but the job is not yet finished.
I trust that you can do all this without harming the children.
Oh, well, it's you just take a few drops of blood, then you cultivate the cells in a culture, and so we go with the cell, we don't go with the child.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you're on the boards of various academies in this world. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I have the honor of being a member of the American Academy of Arts and Science. I'm a member of the Royal Society of Medicine in London, of the Royal Society of Science in Stockholm, of the Science Academy in Italy, in Argentina. I'm a member of the Pontifical Academy of Science, and I'm a member in Paris, in the Institut de France, of the Académie des Sciences Morales et Politiques. It is of moral and political science, a special academy in France, and also the Academy of Medicine in France.
The academy that deals with moral and political science?
Yeah.
Tell us what that academy's function is about, Doctor.
That academy was made around 200 years ago to give advice to the government about moral and political questions, and essentially to give advice to the government about the use of new techniques, considering that the respect of man is one of the basis of our constitution.
Okay.
We have five academies, one of the five academies in the Institute of France.
All right. And then you mentioned another that it gave me some interest. You said the Pontifical Academy. Where is that academy located?
The Pontifical Academy of Science is located inside the gardens of the Vatican. Very nice location. And we are 70 members, and no more than 7 of any country. That we are coming from all the world around. Our percentage of Nobel Prize is more than 60%. And there is no difficulty because we choose a member in the whole earth, and so it's not difficult to choose who we want. The interest is many of them have been selected by the Nobel Committee long before they have been elected by our academy. So I would say it's the only scientific international academy of science. It's the only one which is truly international.
How long have you been on that academy?
12 years, if I remember well, something like that.
Tell us a little bit about the topics that the research that's done there. What have you all considered?
In the academy?
Yes, sir.
Well, for example, we are given the question, what is the danger of the use of atomic energy? For example, we had 4 sessions about the danger of atomic weapons and their numbers, the use of them, the possibility of survival of humanity after an atomic war, and how medicine could do something. And when we did the report, the Holy Fathers asked the Academy to designate members to produce that report to the powers who have the atomic power. And I was sent to discuss that in Moscow with the late Mr. Brezhnev. But it was a very interesting interview during 1 hour discussing with Mr. Brezhnev and the Kremlin about the danger that humanity would feel if there was an atomic exchange.
Did you find that interview interesting, to say the least?
Well, I'm not a diplomat, I'm just a scientist, and it was very interesting for me, at least.
I understand that in this country, you're familiar with our man that is in charge of our health and welfare of all of the citizens of this state.
You may say, but cool, yes.
Yes.
Well, I'm a good friend.
And
I know him since long.
Okay. How long do you know him now?
I'm not good at counting the number of years I know people. Maybe 15 years, something of that kind.
Do you visit with him and speak with him?
Yes.
Does he call your bureau or your agency or your scientific, are you on the phone in Paris?
Oh, no, we have discussed when we meet together. We don't use phone for very important matters. It's better to have a chat.
And what is it? What are his interests in you? In other words, what areas have you all chatted about?
Human genetics, which is my field.
Okay. I believe at this time, Your Honor, I've asked the court to recognize Dr. Levine as an expert, witness in the field, and get you here to testify.
Your Honor, we certainly recognize Dr. McGee's expertise in the field of genetics.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Dr. McGee, as you sit there today, it's fair to say you've come quite a distance, is it not, sir?
Well,
it's fair to say that you've come quite a distance to testify today, is it not?
Well, it's not that far, you know. I'd be faster than that.
You're familiar with the issues, the profound issues that this court is considering, aren't you, Doctor?
Yeah, and that's the reason why I accepted the court.
Thank you. With respect to the issues in this case, you understand what we would say is the factual understanding of how Mr. Davis feels and how Mrs. Davis feels. There's been some publicity about this, has there not, Doctor? You've heard something about their dilemma.
I heard something, but very little. Must be very honest. I don't look at television. I don't listen to the radio. And I only knew when Mr. Palmer telephoned to me. That was the first time I heard about it. So I would not say I'm really knowing the whereabouts.
Okay.
I know there are babies. There are human beings in the fridge. It's dominating.
Thank you, Doctor. So let's start with that aspect of this case. You're familiar with in vitro fertilization?
Yes.
When did you write your first article about it, if you recall?
Oh, yeah, trouble was this. Really, I'm not good with that. It might be 15 years or something.
Okay.
Before it was you.
So before it was used, it had been conceived in man's mind, had it not?
Well, you have to understand that artificial fertilization is something rather old in biology, and it was used for animals long before it was applied to man. And what seems today is extraordinary, that is freezing the human embryo, it was not extraordinary by cow. There is a lot of time that cow have been frozen and used and sent by airmail in little containers. And the novelty is to consider that a technique which was devised for husbandry was good enough for mankind.
Okay. Tell us about in vitro fertilization and your view of it and your perspective in it that you could offer today.
Well, could I speak more about nature of the human being than specifically fecundation in vitro? Because to understand what means fecundation in vitro, we have to understand what means fertilization at the beginning of the human being.
All right.
And if I can say so, I would say that life has a very long history. That each of us has got a very neat beginning, the moment of conception. We know, and all the genetics and all the zoology there to tell us that there is a link between the parents and the children. And this link is made of a long molecule that we can desiccate, a DNA molecule, which is transmitting information from parents to children through generations and generations. As soon as the program written on the DNA, there are 23 different pieces of program carried by the spermatozoa, and there are 23 different pieces carried and homologous by the ovum. As soon as the 23 chromosomes carried by the sperm encounter the 23 chromosomes carried by the ovum, the whole information necessary and sufficient to spell out all the characteristics of the new vein is gathered.
Is what, sir?
Is gathered.
Gathered.
Thank you. And it's very interesting, if I can say, Johanna, to remark that natural sciences and science of the law in fact speak the same language. In that sense, that when we see somebody healthy, well-built, what he said, he has a robust constitution. And when we see a country in which every subject is protected by the law, we say it's an equitable constitution. And by the phenomenon of the writing of a law, you have to spell out every term of a law before it can be considered to be a law. I mean, in the science of the law. And secondly, this information written in the law has to be enacted, and it cannot be before it has been voted for. Now, life does exactly the same thing. Inside the chromosomes is written the program and all the definitions, and in fact, chromosomes are, so to speak, the table of the law of life. And if you get the right number of your table of the law of your life, then you begin your own life. Now, the voting process does exist as well. It is the fertilization itself, because there are a lot of proposals, many, many sperms. Only one got in, and that is the voting process which enacts the new constitution of a man. And exactly as would say a lawyer, once a constitution exists in a country, he can speak about it. The same way, when this information carried by the sperm and by the ovum has encountered each other, then a new human being is defined, because its own personal and human constitution is entirely spelled out. It comes from that, because there are very lots of minute differences in the message given by father, given by mother, and even by the same person. We do not give exactly the same minute information in each sperm or in each egg. It follows that the voting process of the fertilization produces a personal constitution which is entirely typical of this very one human being, which has never occurred again and will occur before and will never occur again. It's an entire novelty. And that was due, that was known for, let's say, not 100 years, but more than 50 years. But the bewildering was the minuteness of the writing of those tables of the law. You have to figure out what is a DNA molecule. I would say it's a long thread of 1 meter of length, cut in 23 pieces. Each piece is coiled on itself very tightly to make spiral of spiral of spiral, so that finally it looks like a little rod that we can see under the microscope, that we call a chromosome. And there are 23 of them carried by father, 23 of them carried by mother. I said the minuteness of the language is bewildering, because if I was bringing here on the court all the 1 meter long DNA on the sperms and all the meter long DNA on the ovum, which will make any of the 5 billion of human beings who will replace ourselves in this planet, this amount of matter would be roughly 2 aspirin tablets. That tells us that nature, to carry the information from father to children, from mother to children, from generation to generation, has used the smallest possible language. And it is very necessary, because life is taking advantage of the movements of the particles of molecules to put order inside the chance development of random movement of particles, so that chance is now transformed according to the necessity of the new being. All the information being written they have to be written in the smallest language possible so that they can dictate how to manipulate particles by particle, atom by atom, molecule by molecule. We have to be with life as a real cross between matter, energy, and information. I would like Johanna give you an impression of what happens now with them. Because most of the human beings have been conceived before fecundation in vitro was used, and most of the humanity will still be made all good days fashion for a long time, I do hope. Normally, when the album is ripe, that is once a week, a month, 15 days after the menses, there is a rupture of the follicle, and the album is, so to speak, taken by the fallopian tube, and it has a special expansion. We call it the papillon, I don't know the name of it. And it can move. And if you take a picture, it looks like as a hand making a slow palpation of the ovary to find where the egg will be laid and to take it. Normally, the egg is a big cell, round, not mobile, floating quietly inside the fluid in the tube. And the tube will manage to carry this big cell towards the uterus by ciliate which move on the descendant of the tube. On the contrary, the sperm is an indefatigable navigator. It has been deposited in the entry of the genitalia of the mother, and normally it goes up through the cervix of the uterus, is swimming during the whole uterine cavity, and it is inside the fallopian tube that is the encounter between few thousand, 10,000, 100,000 of sperm, and the one egg can occur. And it is because every human being has been conceived in nature inside a little tube, a tube of flesh that we call the fallopian tube. The test tube babies are indeed possible because the only difference is that sperm and egg are meeting inside a tube, which is now a tube of glass, because the egg has been removed from the body of the woman and the sperm has been just added to the little vessel. And it's because normal fecundation, I should say fertilization, normal fertilization is occurring inside a tube that if you put the proper medium, it is not at all the inseminator who makes fertilization. It just is put on the right medium, the right hormone, active sperm, and it is the sperm who makes the fertilization. Man would be unable to make a fertilization. It has to be done directly by itself. And it's because they were not only floating on the fluid, that this extracorporeal technique is at all possible. Now, the reproduction process is a very impressive phenomenon in the sense that what is produced is never the matter, but it is information. For example, when you want to reproduce a statue, you can make a mold, and there will be an exact contiguity between the atoms of the statue, of the original, and the atom of the mold. And during the molding process, there will be again, between the plaster and the mold, contact atom by atom, so that you reproduce the statue. But what is reproduced is not the original, because you can make it out of plaster, out of iron, about anything, what is reproduced is a form that the genius of the sculptor had imprinted in the matter. The same thing is true for any reproduction, whether it is done by radio, by television, by photography. What is reprinted or produced is the information and not the matter. The matter is a support of the information. And that explains to us how life is at all possible, because it would be impossible to reproduce matter. Matter is not living. Matter cannot live at all. Matter is matter. What is reproduced and transmitted is an information which will animate matter. Then there is nothing like living matter. What exists is animated matter. And what we learn in genetics is to know what does animate the matter to give, to force the matter to take the form of a human being. To give you an idea, I would take a very simple example. I would take the example of this little advert who's here. You've heard a recorder.
Yes, sir.
Now, chromosomes are a long thread of DNA in which the information is written. They are coiled very tightly on the chromosomes, and in fact, a chromosome is very comparable to a mini cassette in which a symphony is written, the symphony of life. Now, exactly as if you go and buy a cartridge on which the Kleine Nachtmusik von Mozart has been registered, if you put it in a normal recorder, the musician would not be reproduced. The note of music would not be reproduced, they are not there. What would be reproduced is a movement of air which transmits to you the genius of Mozart. It's exactly the same way that life is played on the tiny mini cassettes, which are our chromosome, are written various parts of the opus, which is called human symphony, and as soon as all the information necessary and sufficient to spell out the whole symphony, this symphony plays itself. That is, a new man is beginning his career. In vitro fertilization does not change at all what I say. It's just a technique sometimes used to bypass a difficulty in the encounter of the egg and the sperm. So it's a derivation. It does not change at all the basic mechanism. The basic mechanism is just the same. Now, if I could continue a little more, it's not about fertilization that we're discussing, it's about freezing of embryos. I'm not a specialist of freezing embryos. Johanna have never played with embryos. But in my laboratory, we are freezing cells, we are thawing them, we are using a lot of those processes, so we know about it. We use it on another system than embryos, but just cells are very similar as their reactions. Now, you have to realize, and I don't know if it is true in English, but I think it's quite true, and it is true at least in all the Latin language, we use the same word to define the tempo that we measure with a clock and the temperature that we measure with a thermometer. We say in French temps and température. In English we say time, which is a change of tempos. We say temporal thing and temperature, the clock. And that is not a a mistake of the ordinary language. It's a definition of a basic phenomenon. I don't know how they have recognized it so long ago to build it in language. That is, what means time is the flux of the agitation of the molecule, the flux of the particle which is continually going on. And temperature is just a measure of the speed with which the molecules are running in a given minute. Now, if you diminish progressively in temperature, you diminish the speed and the number of collisions between the molecules, and so to speak, without any joke about the walls, you are progressively slowing down the temperature, you are freezing time. And in fact, we are wrong telling that we are freezing temperatures. In a sense, it's very true, like you deep freeze the meat in the supermarket. Very correct. But in the fundamental sense, what we are doing by lowering down the temperature is stopping, not totally, but very suddenly, the movement of the atoms and molecules, so that in fact, inside the can, the thermal can, in which we put in tiny canisters the cells or the embryo, we have more or less arrested the flux of the time. This seems to be rhetorical, but it is not. Because otherwise we could never understood why it is possible to freeze a cell, to have it entirely not moving, not respirating, not having any chemical exchange, and just, if you have done it with precision so that no crystals have been made inside the cells which could have ruptured is very minute architecture. If you thaw it progressively and carefully, it will again begin to flourish and to divide. Then it's obviously sure that we have not arrested life and started life again. What we have arrested is a time for this particular organism which is inside this can. If we could put a cell down to the -273 centigrade, that is to the absolute zero, every movement would be stopped. And if the temperature would be maintained at that level, it would be kept unchanged for indefinity. I would not say eternity, but indefinity. We are not achieving that when we freeze the cell in my laboratory, and you do the same here. We use not liquid hydrogen because it's very costly, it's very explosive, and it's used only in the NASA for the rocket. We use more modestly nitrogen, liquid nitrogen, because it cannot explode. And it's very cheap, rather cheap. And it's easy to manage. But it's only -180, -190 that we have inside the canister. Well, it's rather cool, but it's not absolute zero. So that's the preservation is not 100%. And probably you could not preserve the cells for more than a number of years that nobody knows, because it depends on the cells. For example, to the best of my knowledge, for ordinary cells, which are very resistant, there are examples of more than 15 years in the canister and being sold and being correctly surviving and alive. For mouse embryo, it's some 10 years. In our species, I think there are no long time, maybe 1 or 2 years, no more than there. And nobody knows, with the actual technique, how long the preservation would be real preservation. It's a question I could not answer. And I think nobody can answer just precisely today. But what I could say that the information which is inside the spread cell obviously tell to the cell all the tricks of the trade to build herself as an individual. This cell is already, I mean, it's not the definition to build a theoretical man, but to build that particular human person that we will call later Margaret or Paul or Peter. It's already there, but it's so small that we cannot see it. It's by induction that we know it for the moment. And I would say I would like to use the felicitous expression of the mathematicians. They would say that man is reduced at its simplest expression, like you can do with an algebraic formula if you manipulate it intelligently. And if you want to know what means that formula, you have to extend it to get value of the various parameters and to get a useful formula. You expand it. It's what does life. The formula is there. If you allow this formula to be expanded by itself, just giving shelter and nurture, then you have the development of the full person. Now, I know that there has been recent discussion of vocabulary, and I was very surprised 2 years ago that some of our British colleagues invented the term of pre-embryo. That does not exist. It has never existed. And I was curious, and I went to the encyclopedia, to the French encyclopedia, and the one I inherited from my great father. But it was 50 years ago that it was printed. And in the term of embryo, it was said that the youngest form of a brain, which is very clear and simple definition, and it stated it starts as one fertilized cell, the fertilized egg, which is called also zygote. And when this zygote splits in two cells, it is called a two-cell embryo. When it's split in four, it is called a four-cell embryo. Then it's very interesting because its terminology accepted the world over for more than 50 years by all the specialists of the world, and we had no need at all of a subclass which would be called a pre-embryo, because there is nothing before the embryo. Before an embryo there is a sperm and an egg, and that's it. And the sperm and an egg cannot be a pre-embryo, because you cannot tell what embryo it grows in, because you don't know what the sperm will grow and what an egg. But once it is made, you have thought the zygote, when it divides, it's an embryo, and that's it. I think it's important because people would believe that a pre-embryo does not have the same significance that an embryo. And in fact, on the contrary, a first cell knows more and is more specialized, if I could say, than any cell which is later in our organism. Now, I don't know if I can have you with this,
Dr. Turner, before that short break, I was asking you about your familiarity with the center of care. I'm going to ask you that question again for your benefit. Can you tell the jury whether or not you are familiar with the recognized standard of care of both radiologists and x-ray technicians in communities similar to Knoxville and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for observing good sterile techniques and preventing infection in the performance and preparation for a myelogram during September of 1985?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Turner, at the request of Mr. Hall and myself, I believe you have reviewed certain matters in this case. Would you please tell the jury what you have reviewed in preparation for your testimony today?
I have reviewed the hospital chart in depth.
Are you referring to the hospital chart that was made on September 22nd, 1985?
Exactly.
And for your benefit, that has been made collectively given one to this trial. What else have you reviewed?
Various depositions.
Okay. Can you tell the jury what depositions you reviewed?
Gosh, several. I reviewed the depositions of the radiologist, the orthopedic physician, the two x-ray technicians, the infection control nurse. I'm not remembering their names. I hope that's not important. Also the nurses that cared for the patient that last 24 hours before he was transferred to the intensive care unit.
Dr. Turner, there's two main topics that I want to question you about today and to keep them separated. I've asked you, of course, about your familiarity with the standard of care for aseptic technique and maintaining sterility in the forms of myogram. That's the first main category I want to ask you about today. Mm-hmm. To go ahead and for the jury's benefit, I'm also going to be asking you about the second category. Are you familiar with the recognized standard of care of hospital personnel such as nurses, LPNs, and RNs in communities similar to Knoxville and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, in caring for and assessing post-myelogram patients such as Mr. Kirkendall during the time period of September 1985?
Yes, sir.
And the second thing.
The third was young, the one day. Just after fecundation, after it has spread in two cells, then in three cells. Because curiously, we do not split ourselves in two, four, eight, and continue like that. No, at the beginning we don't do that. We split in two cells of roughly equal dimension. And then one of the two cells generally split in two. And there is a moment in which inside the zona pellucida, which is a kind of plastic bag, which is, so to speak, the wall of the private life of the embryo, in which it is protected from the outside, we have a stage in which there are three cells. This has been known for 50, 60 years, and it was remaining a mystery for embryologists. Because after that stage of three cells, it starts again, it comes to four, and then it continues by a multiple of two. Now, what could be the meaning? We do not know yet the accurate meaning, but it has a great importance about this discussion we have today, the cause. We can manipulate non-human embryos, like, for example, mice. We can disassemble the cells, which are inside the zona pellucida of 16 cells, embryo of mice, and take few cells of it, take few cells from another embryo, of another type of embryo, if you wish, and put all that together inside a new zona pellucida from which we have expelled the legitimate occupant. Now, what happens? It's most of the time it fails. But what happens is sometimes a chimera goes out, and you see, for example, if you have chosen a black embryo, a white embryo, and you have mixed them together, you find a little tiny mouse, which can run on your table, but which has a chess ball on the body, part are black, part are white, because she had built herself of two types of cells that you had put together in the same zone after losing them. It has to be done with a very small number of cells. Now, we have tried, and when I say we, geneticists, have tried to put three different lines, and they have got two mice with three different types of cells that they can see on the photo. They have tried four, doesn't work. Five, doesn't work. It's only possible with three cells. And that remembers that when we split at the beginning of our life, two cells and then one cell in two that we go at three cell stage, it's probably at that time that the message goes from one cell to the two other cells, come back to the first one, and they suddenly realize we are not a population of cells. We are bound to be an individual. That is individuation. What makes the difference between a population of cells, which will make just a tissue culture, and an individual, which will live himself according to his own rule, is demonstrated at the three-cell stage, that is very soon after fertilization has occurred. If we stop it, if we slow down the movement of the molecule, we will progressively come to a relative standstill. And when the embryo is frozen, this tiny human brain, they are very small, 1.5 millimeters of the dimension, little sphere, 1.5 millimeters. You can put them in canisters by thousands. And then, with due connotation, the fact of putting inside a very chilly space tiny human beings who are deprived of any liberty, of any movement. Heavens, they are deprived of time. Time is frozen for them. Make them surviving, so to speak, in a suspended time on a concentration camp. And it's not as hospitable, as prepared to life, as would be the secret temple which is inside the female body, that is a womb, which is by far a much better equipped physiologically, chemically, and I would say intellectually, than our best laboratories for the development of the new human being. That's the reason why, thinking about those things, I was deeply moved when you phoned to me, knowing that Madame, the mother, wanted to rescue babies from this concentration camp and to give to the baby. I would not use the term baby, it's not perfectly accurate, it's not good English. Would offer to those early human beings their own flesh, their hospitality, that she is the best in the world to give them. And because Mr. Pender told me on the phone that it had been said that if you, madam, were not entitled to give this shelter to the baby, to the early human beings, they perfectly correct in what I mean, you would prefer that it would be enjoying another shelter and not being left inside the concentration camp destroyed. And I was impressed because it reminded me of an extraordinary trial which has occurred more than 2,000 years ago. I could not believe it could appear again. That two persons will discuss whether it's better to have an early human being alive and given to a certain person, or another person would prefer the baby not being alive. And to the best of my recollection, this judgment has been considered as a parangon of justice by Solomon David. I was not thinking I would come from Paris to speak in Tennessee about a 2,000 years old trio. But I realized when you phoned me, it was the first time it was arising in this earth, with a very early human being, because we thought early human beings were not on our reach. They were protected inside the secret temple. And then I felt it was opportunity that the geneticist was going to tell you what our own science tells us. But if this trio had taken place 2 years before, I would have stopped, because I would have told you all that we knew at that moment. But with your permission, Your Honor, I will continue a little faster. Faster. We know much more since the last 2 years. We know that the uniqueness of the early human being I was talking at the beginning, which was a statistical certainty, but an inference of all that we knew about the frequency of the genes, about the difference between individuals, is now an experimentally demonstrated fact that has been discovered less than 2 years ago by Jeffries in England.